Hello and welcome. Today I am joined by Dr. Anita Biswas, who is the head of sports medicine at the UK Sports Institute and also co-lead for the Female Athlete Health and Performance Programme. So Anita, thank you for joining.
Yeah, it's nice to see you.
Likewise. So we had a quick chat beforehand, but how's all the prep for Paris going?
I think it's going pretty well. You know, we're seasoned professionals now, building up to a games. The athletes are going through their qualification processes, their selection processes, and trying to get themselves in a good state, really, for their performance.
So when does, when does the anxiety is the wrong word, but like the real sort of prep and pressure start to feel like, right, okay, now we're getting into like that running period?
It depends on the sport. So there's some sports that have already qualified. The athletes may have been selected already, and probably at the moment, then the period is relatively quiet, but ramping up towards the games. There'll be other sports who are right in the middle of it. You know, they don't know, the athletes don't know whether they're going, the sports don't know if they've qualified. So, you know, it is very different for different sports. Clearly, the energy builds up in the weeks before the games, when it becomes a reality that, you know, you're going, hopefully, that your sport are going, that you're part of the team. And then that's for the athletes is when it all really builds up. And I think quite an important day for athletes is when they go to kitting out and they get their bag full of stash and kit. And I think that's probably when it really hits home to the athletes that this is it. Will they be working towards?
And I can imagine that'd be the same for some of the practitioners, because again, not everyone gets to go to these games. So is it similar for when you're involved in it on the medical side?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is different when you're a practitioner. But, you know, if you're going to your first games, it's still that moment, you know, and often people have been building up for years and years to get the opportunity to go. What we do often find, certainly with the doctors, is that you have quite a few experienced doctors that have been to a games before. That doesn't mean you don't get excited, but, you know, perhaps less excited by the T-shirt as other people. But we've been working on this for 4 years. You know, we've been building up to this for 4 years. So when you do a cycle and then another cycle and then another cycle, perhaps it is slightly different for us. But definitely if you're, you know, a young practitioner, and you've been building up to go into your first games, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, we'll come back to some of the Olympic chat a bit later on. So just getting back to you then. So where are you from originally?
Well, I was brought up at 5 o'clock on the M25. Went to school in Croydon. And went to Nottingham University. So moved out of area to go to university, but travelled a bit before. Travelling was always my thing, so I took time out when I could. So I think I had a pretty conventional upbringing, really, albeit that, you know, my father's from India, so he was one of the few, well, he was the only ethnic minority in our village, so that was fairly unusual, I suppose, from the growing up point of view.
Right, and so what was prompting you to want to go into this line of work?
Well, unfortunately, I do have a cheesy story about this. So when I was 4 or 5, I wanted to be a nurse because I cared about people. I wanted to make them better, like you do when you're 4 or 5. And then when I was about 6, I was watching the Olympics with my mum and I said, oh, actually, I don't want to be a nurse. I want to be a doctor. And she looked at me like I was mad, probably realizing at that point maybe I wasn't quite smart enough. But and she said, oh, why do you want to be a doctor? And I said, because I want to make people like that better. And she said, but they're the fittest people in the world. And I said, and somebody pulled their hamstring in the 100 meters. And I said, he needs making better. That's what I want to do. So I was very young. I don't, have very conscious mindset about that day. But my mum recalls that story. And I've got no reason to believe she's not telling the truth.
Yeah, no, that is amazing. Is there any background of medicine in the family?
No, well, no, but my sister copied me. She's younger than me, older than me, sorry. And she was very bright and was told she could be a lawyer or a doctor. So she chose medicine. And so then everybody was saying, oh, you want to be a doctor like your sister? And I was like, no, my sister is a doctor like me. But before that, none. Yeah, no, we don't have medicine in our family at all. And certainly my children have no intention of following in my footsteps. So it's not an inherited condition, I don't think.
And then you mentioned like your academic thing. I'm sure you've been slightly underplaying it there, but it's in terms of like your background, because one of the interesting things is I've chatted to so many people at really high levels. And a lot of people have said I wasn't, not that they were rubbish at school, but they really weren't standing out. Like, what was your experience for that?
Yeah, I mean, similarly, that I didn't, I wasn't stupid. I academically, I worked hard like many doctors have. But I did get taken aside by one of my teachers at school. I'm not going to name her in case she happens to see this podcast. And she said that they'd been talking about me in the staff room, and they said that they weren't sure that I was able to do medicine, that I would get the grades. Fortunately for me, I'm quite stubborn, and also fortunately for me, they decided to give me a chance by predicting grades they didn't think I could get, so that I had a chance of getting into medical school. And because I'm stubborn, I did. So, you know, it worked out, but it wasn't easy. I failed exams at medical school, and then I failed my resit sometimes. But, you know, I got through in the end, and I ended up getting a 2-1, which wasn't disgraceful. So, you know, if you want to do it, I genuinely believe you can do it. You've just got to want to do it enough.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great lesson for anything, isn't it? Anything you're doing, if you've got that belief and consistency and drive to continue doing it. Yeah. I mean, that's... can you remember like how you did feel when you had that conversation with the teacher that was saying that?
I can actually, because my sister had gone to Cambridge University, and I'd been asked, well, I'm basically my father wanted me to try for Oxbridge. And so I was doing all the lessons, and she also said, look, you're not going to get into Oxbridge, so you need to bin that idea. And so I can remember at the time thinking, well, I never wanted to go to Oxford or Cambridge anyway, so I'm okay with that. I was going to get my place and then reject it. But there's no way you're stopping me going to medical school. Just watch me. And fortunately, it worked out okay. but it was, you know, it was touch and go at times. But I knew that I'd been so young, there was no doubt in my mind that I was going to do it. So I did.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. And then, but like, Nottingham's got a great reputation for medicine as well. How did you end up there?
Yeah, I mean, like everybody, you look around, don't you, when you're trying to decide which uni you want to go to. And I was a little bit swayed by so my best friend's dad was very influential. Her parents met at Nottingham University, and he told me about the fact that they had a great time there. So I had a look at Nottingham. I had a look at Bristol. I loved both of them. I was happy to go to either. I can't remember looking at anywhere else. I must have done. But I don't think you had to have 5 choices like you do now. I think you can choose 5. And I was fortunate in that I got offered a place at both, but got into my first choice. So, you know, again, it's, you know, you take your chance, don't you? And if you're lucky, you get it. So I think I've been lucky.
Yeah. And so you talked earlier, like when you were 5, you were really looking at working in sport. But like, what at that point when you were at Nottingham, what were you thinking you were going to end up doing?
Well, I always wanted to do sports medicine. And it's funny when you go to your reunions and you see other people from medical school, and they say, you know, they thought I was nuts because they like sport as well, some of them, but then it never occurred to them to try and do it as a career. And, you know, I predate training programs. There wasn't a training program. It wasn't even really a recognized thing to do, although there were people working in sport. You know, I ended up like many people in my specialty who qualified at the sort of time that I did. doing jobs that seem to be vaguely related to sports medicine, musculoskeletal medicine. So I did A&E. Well, it's now, I'm an ED now, but it was A&E in those days. I really enjoyed that. I was good at it. They wanted me to go do that as a career, but I wasn't very good at doing night shifts. So I thought, this isn't going to ever work for me. And I still want to do sport. I quite liked kids. So I thought maybe I'll do a bit of pediatrics for a bit of fun. Really liked that, but knew it wasn't what I wanted to do. And then I did, because I still couldn't find my way into sports medicine, I did pediatric A&E in Sheffield. And that was my next lucky break, really, because having missed out on my membership part one by one or two questions only, I was asked what I wanted to do, really. And, you know, my educational supervisor knew that my heart wasn't in it. And I said, I want to do sports medicine. So she sent me to the orthopedics clinics. They said, this person wants to be an orthopedic surgeon. I said, no, I don't. I want to be an orthopedic physician. And they said, you need to go meet Brian English. He's in the hospital next door doing sports. Well, basically being an orthopedic physician. And that moment, you know, Brian knows that I think it, but it changed my life, because if for that, I might have carried on doing a bit of this and a bit of that. And he said, come and sit in my clinics. And I said, great. He said, go and get your master's degree. And I said, yep, absolutely. And then he said, come and work on the Everest Marathon with me. And I said, that sounds fun. I'll do that too. So that would have been back in 1994, 95.
Right. So what was Brian's working in the NHS then?
Yeah, as an orthopaedic physician.
Right. Oh, interesting. So what was Brian like back then? I've just worked with him in various different roles that he's been in.
Oh, I couldn't possibly say in public. No, he was great. I mean, obviously, he gave me an opportunity and gave me a direction, whereas before I'd been, you know, running in lots of different directions, trying to find my path. And if you think that it was 2006, really, when we got recognised as a specialty, it was another 10 years before, 9 years before we got to that point. So there were a lot of people trying to find their way in what has turned out to be a fantastic specialty when it didn't really exist.
Yeah. So what was the Everest trip like?
Oh, amazing. I'm so good. I did it twice. I think if anybody gets a chance to do it, it's extraordinary. You know, working medicine at high altitude, whilst, you know, we ended up doing a big chunk of that marathon distance to get back to our stations. I would do it again tomorrow if I could, for sure.
God, I mean, yeah, what the athletes and what conditions are they running in then, and like, how are they running? What's the times in for an Everest marathon?
Yeah, I couldn't tell you the exact time. So what they do is they run from the same altitude as Everest base camp. It's not actually Everest base camp, but it's from Lobosher, and they run down in altitude, but there are ups and downs. So it's a fell run, and then there's a loop. Well, this is what it was in my day. I don't know if it's changed. And then there was a 6K loop at the end. And, you know, there were all sorts of people doing it. So they were all keen fell runners mainly. And I mean, the two times I did it was run by a local. But that wasn't mainly the point of it. I think it was more about the experience. And, you know, we trekked for 3 weeks to the beginning of the marathon, and then we had a race day. So, you know, you developed pretty good friendships along the way and had some great experiences and lots of diarrhea.
I'll make a clip of that one.
Maybe not.
So yeah, and then so when you've done that, like, amazing experience, what were you actually doing then? What were you coming back to when you were doing as your day job, I guess? And like, what were the opportunities you could see beyond in sports?
Yeah, so So at that point, there was still wasn't a career for me in sports medicine as such. So I did my master's degree, and again, probably got a bit lucky because Nick Webborn, another person who had a big influence in my career, was working. He was heading up the department when I did my master's, and he had close contacts with Headley Court, the Defence Services Medical Rehab Centre. And through that, we went and visited, and we were all invited to apply for jobs if we were interested. So I did go and work there, which was a really good experience for me. And I was lucky enough to be able to do more than just a 6 month job. I actually stayed on as an acting registrar. That led me to think, well, okay, this is all very well, but I still haven't got a proper job. You know, I haven't got a career yet. So I just bodged together GP training. That counted, my paediatrics counted, my emergency medicine counted. And so I did a year as a trainee GP. I knew very, very early on that that wasn't what I wanted to do. But fortunately, in my practice that I worked at, my trainer hated musculoskeletal medicine and backs and things. So I did it all. So I did loads of musculoskeletal medicine, but I'm probably not so good at hypertension and ischemic heart disease management. So, you know, so again, that worked out for me. And then I was coming towards the end of that, and I had a phone call saying, probably my next bit of luck really was, do you fancy coming to Sydney with the Paralympic team? And I, because they were looking for a female with GP background who had some disability background. And from Headley Court, I had the disability. I just finished my GP training, and I went, yeah, go on then, if you insist. So I had to be unemployed. I made myself unemployed. There was no payment. There was no time off given. I had no job to come back to, and I was away for 8 weeks. And when I came back, I couldn't get a job. I couldn't find anything. I couldn't get locum work. Locum work had dried up. And I was getting desperate, very desperate. And in the end, I started looking at orthopaedic jobs, and there at the top in the BMJ was clinical fellow in sports medicine in Nottingham. And I was living in Bracknell, and commuting to Nottingham to do that job. And I did it for a year, and I haven't looked back. You know, I've worked in full-time in elite sport or musculoskeletal medicine ever since. But even before that, I'd worked with the British cycling team. I'd worked with England women's football in the days where they didn't have their own kit. They were using the men's kit. And, you know, I'd just taken every opportunity. And a lot of sports medicine in those days, you did for nothing. You volunteered. You weren't paid for a lot of it. But then, yes, after 2000, I managed to actually get paid and properly for a job, and haven't done any general practice really since. Certainly haven't done paediatrics or membership exams or anything other than sports medicine, which is nice.
Yeah, no, for sure. So what was Sydney like then? What was that whole experience like?
So it was a bit of a baptism of fire, I'm going to be honest. There are only two doctors. There's considerably more now. And I was out there with Tom Crisp, and I, although I'd worked in disability from the military perspective, I'd never worked with a Paralympic athlete. I didn't know all the disabilities. I didn't know all the classifications. I learned a huge amount very quickly. One of the phenomenal things for me was walking into the dining room and just seeing thousands of people with varying levels of disability managing normal life things that you or I might think were impossible, but they'd adapted, and just really being really impressed, but also probably quite humbled by the little gripes that we, the little moans that we have about, you know, this hurts or that's not working properly or we're not happy about something, and just seeing that actually life for some people is very different, and particularly those from third world countries who didn't have the fancy prostheses and they didn't have all the additional things that maybe some of our athletes have. So it was I mean, it was extraordinary and it was humbling, and it seems like an awful long time ago now.
Yeah, no, actually, I caught up with Richie Barber recently, who won a silver there, and you know, what an incredible story his is, like what he's gone on to do as well. Yeah, because you must have been you were still relatively inexperienced then, and then there's two of you dealing with, well, a lot going on, I can imagine.
Yeah, and I think, you know, because there were only two of us, the CMO in those situations quite often gets pulled off to meetings, and you know, so there was quite often it was just me in there. You know, it was Tom was off doing other things. You know, he was there some of the time. So I do remember things coming through the door that I'd never seen before that I was having to deal with. I don't think I made any mistakes. I haven't been told I did, but you just learn really quickly. I mean, I think that we can, you know, that environment that I grew up in terms of medicine, where you learn on the job a little bit, and whilst may not have been the safest, it's definitely a really, really quick way to learn. And, you know, I probably did spend quite a bit of time on the phone to the UK saying help. Has anybody got any experience of this? But yeah, it probably made me, I would think, realistically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I can imagine that you certainly would be. You'd have to learn pretty quickly and be able to deal with a bit of pressure as well. So when you came back then, so what was your next big role? And were you still doing Headley Court work then?
No, so I'd finished at Headley Court, and I had actually, before I went, gone to Frimley Park, because I'd been advised that maybe I should go down the medicine route and try and do rheumatology. But actually, when I got back, I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do, and I got the clinical fellowship in sports medicine. So I was able then to go to back to Nottingham to do that. When I got back, I think I had about maybe 3 or 4 months where I was unemployed and had no work at all before that came up. And then I did that. And then once I'd finished, so I did a year of that. Then I came back home and actually had been invited to join a private practice and do sports medicine in that practice with some orthopaedic surgeons. And all that time I say dabbled, but you know, I volunteered for things. And then it would have been 2002, maybe 2001, 2002. The British Paralympic Association were looking for a chief medical officer, and I was lucky enough to get that job. So that was the next big learning curve, which was an extraordinarily big learning curve, that one. So that was from probably 2002 to 2007. And I went to Athens Paralympics and Torino as chief medical officer. But the great thing at that point, so after Sydney, lottery funding started coming into sport and into Paralympic sport. So actually, Paralympic sport accelerated quite rapidly at that time in terms of input and support for the athletes and the things we were able to do. So it was a really quite an important time in sport and sports medicine. Meanwhile, obviously, we were trying to get an Olympics in London. So we were, as a group, trying to campaign for the law to be changed so that sports medicine could be recognised as a specialty, because it did require a law change. So Mark Batt was one of the people that helped to drive that. But behind him were a group of us writing a curriculum. The very first curriculum was written whilst I was a clinical fellow in Nottingham, with a group of fantastic people all starting from scratch, saying, well, what do you need to know to do a specialty that doesn't exist? And then obviously we got recognised as a specialty, which was a big day for us.
So Mark Batt, he's Nottingham. He was a Nottingham guy as well, isn't he?
Yeah. So he was my supervisor when I was in Nottingham doing my clinical fellowship. So we've crossed paths a few times over the years.
Yeah, I'm sure. So when you're getting, like, what are the characteristics and traits that they're looking mm-hmm. For a chief medical officer? What are they looking for over and above being a doctor that's working within a team?
Yeah, I mean, I think to work in sport, realistically, you need to be a team player. You can't be somebody that thinks about yourself over and above everybody else. For it to work, you need to be a team player. You need to be adaptable and flexible. So yes, I'm a doctor, but I do other things. Yeah, I'm not above making tea. I am not above shifting bags. And I think you do have to have that flexibility. We do need to have boundaries, but we also need to recognize that sometimes we're going to have to do things that are outside our comfort zone, especially if you're a traveling team physician. You know, you could be working in a hotel room, you could be working in your hotel room, not ideal, but it can happen. You can be working on a track, you can be working in a field. So you have to have that adaptability. You cannot just be used to or only work in hospital environments. And that requires you to think outside the boxes. You don't always have everything you would like to have in a hospital environment. And I've traveled recently where I thought, well, if I was in a hospital and I had all these people around me, I would do this. But in this environment, for it to be safe for the athlete, I need to do that. And it might be slightly different. So you do need that adaptability. You need to be quite patient, and you probably need to understand that not everything happens between 9 and 5. Most of us who have worked in sports medicine for a while have had phone calls at 11 o'clock on a Saturday night when we're in bed, when we're in Sainsbury's with the kids. And whilst we can not take them, usually people need us to take those calls. We get calls from China, which might be at 2 or 3 in the morning in the UK. Yeah, so you have to have a degree of flexibility, I think. And you probably need to know how to have a bit of fun, because those environments can be quite stressful. Certainly the times that I remember most from the events that I've done over the years have been the ones where we've had a bit of fun. Yeah, we've worked hard, but we've also let off steam, probably done things that we shouldn't have done. But actually, it's the thing that's kept us sane when we've worked 17-hour days. So
how do you interview for that?
Well, for those well, it's interesting. Oh, no,
specifically the fun one.
Oh, the fun one. Well, I don't know is the question, is the answer to that. I think, look, what we do now, I know what some of the multi-game, multi-sport games environment interviews are more than just a sit-down interview now. They do team building type things to see how people respond in those more challenging environments. Ultimately, in a lot of sports, you get interviewed on the job, and if you're not up to it, they'll let you know one way or another.
Yeah, and I guess it's quite a small part, isn't it, of people's, maybe everyone knows everyone, you will know someone most likely that will have worked with someone else.
Yeah,
so I can imagine there's a lot of networking and referrals going on there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things I would say if you're a younger doctor coming into this environment is, you know, we all make mistakes sometimes. It's how we respond to mistakes that's important, because our world is quite small. If you respond badly to a mistake, and I more mean like a team fit mistake rather than a clinical mistake, it's how you respond that will make the difference as to whether you get asked back or you get, you know, whether that network works in or against your favour. You're not going to fit in everywhere. You're not always going to get it right. And if you don't get it right, then that's okay. We're all different, and not every environment suits all of us.
Mm. Yeah. And then because you've gone on to be like the heads and like leading different things again, what are the additional skill sets that you need for that, as opposed to, again, working as a doctor, but you know what I mean? As in leading a team.
Yeah. So I think one of the things that, I think you need to do when you're leading is, it comes back to that, it's not an I. What I have to be able to do is I have to be able to see the big picture, not my picture. And the big picture might not be the same as my picture. My view might be in one direction, and that, you know, my preferences might be in one direction. But does that suit everybody around me? You know, I might want to achieve A, but if achieving A means that B, C, D, and E don't get achieved, and that's the priority for other people around me, then I can't just focus on A. I have to think about those other things. So, you know, the people I work with may or may not agree with this or have seen it, but certainly whenever I'm processing what I need to do and how to achieve it, I try and include the values and the thoughts of everybody in my team, but also need to think about the whole organization or the whole group. And that is hard. It's quite hard work, because sometimes you're looking at from trying to look at something from a point of view that is completely opposed to what your normal point of view would be and what your values would be. But you have to see other people's perspective. Otherwise, a team just doesn't work. Ultimately, you have to make the decision, and it's not always going to be popular. So then I find it quite hard if I think people don't like me. I like to be liked. Probably all of us do, really. But you have to make decisions that are, you know, that aren't popular sometimes, and you have to go away and go, right, they might not like that, and they might not even like you for it, but that, if you, as long as you're sure that's the right decision, you have to stick with it.
And what support and development do you get, like, outside of the clinical world to be able for you to develop your own skills? Because again, it is a very different skill set to leading a team to treating someone.
Well, I think medicine, you know, part of our training is about leading anyway, because if you look at the typical hierarchy in a hospital, doctors are usually at the top of the tree, rightly or wrongly, and there's arguments both ways. In medicine, in sports medicine, certainly in team medicine, that hierarchy is less obvious, and often, you know, we're in football and other environments. The person who's leading the sports medicine and science department is often a physio or another discipline. So, you know, I don't see that we have the same hierarchy, but we are trained as we come through medical school to be able to lead. That is part of our training, and often by baptism of fire, but, you know, that's part of our training. I mean, I'm quite lucky at the UK Sports Institute in that we've got some really good leaders there who are mentors, friends, supporters. I've got colleagues that are senior like I am that I lean on. And, you know, sometimes when I'm trying to make a decision that I know is going to be unpopular, I will pass it by other people to make sure that I'm seeing it from other people's point of view, not just mine. So I do lean on my colleagues quite a lot. We do have a mentoring scheme at the UKSI where we have a non-discipline specific mentor that helps us. And again, it's around, you know, how you lead and how you influence and things like that. So, you know, there's loads of opportunities out there. And lovely for those coming through training now is that the faculty have some brilliant emerging leadership courses and mentoring schemes and things. So none of that was there when I was growing up. You know, it wasn't there. We were a much smaller group of doctors then, so, you know, we all knew each other. Now there's lots of doctors that in our discipline that I don't know, but I know of. In those days, you knew everybody, and so therefore we all helped each other out, and we all lent on each other. So, you know, we all have our own ways of doing it. And then I've got friends that are medics in other disciplines that, you know, sometimes if I'm really struggling, I'll go to them and say, right, what would you do in public health? What would you do in academia, you know, in this situation?
I think it is quite a unique environment there. Well, were you planning to want to be, say, the head of sports medicine? Was that an aspiration that you did want to, say, get these, some of these senior positions?
No, it definitely wasn't an aspiration. But I guess one of the things working at the UKSI for so long, because I stayed there for quite, you know, I've been there a long time, was that you end up, there's a natural evolution where you kind of move. And I'm I'm somebody who does, I would say, I get bored. I don't have a great attention span, so I do change things quite often. And I have done, if you kind of patch my CV together, I think I've pretty much changed something every 6 months of my career, and not the whole job, but bits of it. And so the natural evolution was for me to move into roles at UKSI. I mean, with the BPA, you know, I never thought that I was a leader, really, but I got the job and I had to find a way of doing it. You know, it's like with everything, you develop your skills according to the situation you're in. I do keep getting the job, so I must be doing something okay.
So you don't know why, like, what did you know why you have got those roles? Have you had feedback as to why you have?
I have no idea. I think you'd have to ask other people, really. I suppose people do know that they will get one. They get what they see with me. You know, I'm pretty authentic. I'm pretty genuine, and they will. If I'm not happy, I'll tell them. And if I think somebody needs changing, I'm not afraid to say, look, I'm not sure this is right. I work pretty hard. Again, they know they're going to get their pound of flesh from me. I'm not going to be not earning my crust. So I guess those two things help. You get jobs, and then because it is a small world, you know, people must say, well, she's okay.
Yeah, well, sometimes it is just like the real basic things of reliability, you know, yeah. It's just like consistency, whatever. Like sometimes those tiny little things do make a massive difference in, well, people knowing they can trust you, because it is a significant trust. Like, yes. You were, you know, chief medical officer for how many games? For?
So chief medical officer for 3, I think. And then, yeah, 3. And then, but I've attended 2 others.
And how does that differ then, that's for you, from a stress perspective or responsibility?
As a CMO, it depends what your role is. So you can be a CMO in a single sport, and that has one level of stress. And then you could be a CMO across the whole team. And I mean, my hardest games by a long way was Athens. And that was for lots of reasons. One was probably, it was my first games in charge. It was my first real leadership job in that situation. There were just lots of challenges from beginning to end, I think it feels like. But I had a fantastic team supporting me, and I'm still incredibly grateful to one of the nurses taking me aside and saying, right, we're going to play this game, which I'm not going to name in public. And us literally hurling each other down a physio room on a wheelie stool to a target, and it just diffused everything. Whenever she could see that it was becoming too much and I was overwhelmed, she took me aside and made me laugh. And I'm so grateful for that, because you can get very bogged down in, you know, the seriousness and the importance of the role that you're doing and how the impact it can have on the athletes you're supporting.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, certainly with you in that, one of the most amazing experiences. And if you're not enjoying it as well, it's like, that's, it's not good for anyone.
No, definitely not.
Yeah. And then, so for like your role as female athlete health and like that optimizing health, how did that come about?
So I started off, so obviously I was working at the UK Sports Institute, and because of the sort of, you're probably getting the impression now that I'm a little bit of a terrier. So if I get an idea into my head, I kind of gnaw, I keep grabbing at your trouser leg until you listen to me. And I do remember having a conversation, and I can tell you where it was and who it was with at the UK Sports Institute when it was the EIS. About the fact that I thought we were missing a trick in terms of illness prevention. I said, look, it's all very well having the best coaches, but if we're not keeping athletes well, then, and I think a lot of things that we're seeing are avoidable, you know, we were looking at injury prevention quite a bit. You know, obviously physios had been a bit more forward thinking perhaps than doctors in that respect. So there was lots of work being done around injury prevention, but not illness prevention. And I said, look, we're losing days. And we started actually collecting data that showed that we were losing huge numbers of days from avoidable illness. And I made the mistake of saying to the person I was talking to at the time, I actually think if we could get people to wash their hands a bit more, we can make a difference. I think it's behavioral change will make a difference. And I got laughed at. It took me a little while longer before people started listening to that. And actually, let me think, which games would it have been? I can't remember whether it was probably was pre-London that people started asking for hand washing. I can't remember. But it was we started talking about hand washing workshops and things like that and getting people to actually change their behavior slightly. COVID was like a massive impactor in that because suddenly other people were saying, wash your hands, stay away from crowds, you know, all the things that we know can reduce your illness. And so that was the illness bit. The UKSI developed an athlete health team, which they didn't have a doctor in to start with. It was all physios. And I spoke to our medical director and said, I think that you could probably do with a doctor in there. I'll put my hand up. And again, worked with a fantastic team of people who were trying to make a difference, trying to think differently around performance from a health perspective. The female athlete side of things really came about after London when it was clear that our females were not able to convert their talent into medals in the same way as our male athletes. So we were looking at our medal tallies and seeing that 30% of our medals were in females compared to, you know, 70% of males. Whereas if you looked at the Chinese team and the American team, it was roughly 50-50. We had 50% of athletes in London were female, but yeah, only 30% of our medals were coming from females. And I started having conversations with people about it. We were looking at dropout rates in the pro development programs, you know, why were girls dropping out of sport? And Alex Stacey was doing some really good work there in terms of the pathways. And then I incidentally had a conversation with my co-lead, Richard Burden, and we said, right, let's try and do something about this. Let's start trying to look into it. But it took us quite a long time, really, for it to be recognised, because women's sport still wasn't getting the attention. So although in Olympic sport, we recognised that 50% of our athletes were not getting 50% of our medals, you know, it's always a challenge when we're working in four-year cycles with limited budgets. You know, so where do you put your money? It's you put your money where you think you're going to make the most progress. So Rich and I did have to push quite hard, and we did have to work quite hard to get that recognition for the female athlete health and performance. But fortunately we did. And Emma Ross, who was head of physiology at the time, pulled the bits of work that were being done in the organisation together and managed to create a programme which hasn't looked back really. It's still very small. People still can't believe that actually our team total time is not a full-time equivalent, so we don't have a full-time person doing our program yet. I'm still hoping that will change, but you know, all of us would acknowledge that in the last 5 years there's been way more noise around women's sport. We're seeing it on television. We weren't 6, 7, 8 years ago seeing netball on television. We weren't seeing women's football every weekend, you know. It's massively expanding. Women's cricket, you know, it's lovely to be able to turn the TV on and be able to see that. You couldn't do that before.
Yeah, no, it definitely has changed, notably on the BBC website and so on. Another sport that is probably had the most parity, I would say, over the years has been tennis, which is another one that you're really involved in.
Yeah.
And like, how did that tennis connection come about?
Well, that, again, so it's 25 years since I started working in tennis, which is quite a long time, and it's making me feel a bit old. But it started off because when I was working in my clinical fellowship job, I I got asked through Mark Batt if I would do Edgbaston Ladies Tennis Tournament. And I thought, yeah, I'll give that a go, like I do. If I haven't done it before, I'll give it a go. And I think I was there for, probably was there for 8 years, 9 years, maybe even 10 years, quite a few years. And I loved it. I was living in Berkshire, and it just was becoming harder and harder to do. I got asked if I would be interested in going to Eastbourne and doing the Eastbourne tournament. And I had a couple of kids in there. So again, it was like juggling everything. So I did Eastbourne and then got asked to do Queen's, which I did for 10 years and loved working at Queen's. I worked with a brilliant group of physios. And that was one of the things that I loved about tennis, was that the physios I was working with were exceptional. I mean, I've worked with some really good physios over the years, but I never failed to learn something from them. And I enjoy that. I enjoy being challenged. I enjoy learning from other people, different, you know, that you've got physios from all over the world come to tennis tournaments. So you're not just learning what physios do in the UK, you're learning from the Australians and the Canadians and the Americans and the Mexicans and the Germans, and you know, it's fantastic. And then they were looking for another doctor at Wimbledon. So I, in fact, there were two of us started at the same time. And then when Mark Batt and Phil retired, I took on the lead role at Wimbledon. So yeah, that's what I'm doing tennis wise now, just Wimbledon. I say just Wimbledon.
Yeah, well, just Wimbledon. Yeah. Just Wimbledon. Yeah.
Only Wimbledon, should I say.
Yeah, no, I'm a member of the Northern in Manchester. So I know that the Brodies, and they've obviously, it's got a good heritage. And we've had the tournaments at that club over the years as well. No, brilliant. Look, I really appreciate you sharing your time today, Anita. It's really fascinating. You have got a real unique story in this world. And it's great to hear your insights for leading your team and working in some of those environments. So I appreciate it, and best of luck in the run up to Paris.
Thank you very much.
No problem. Yeah. And remember to play that game. If you are getting stressed out again, then remember to get that nurse and do that game on the whatever it was. You can let me know off camera on that one.
Yeah. Shout out to Georgina.
Brilliant. Thanks, Anita.
Okay. Thank you.